Welcome to episode 12 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. This is part one of this week's episodes, in which we are joined by my friend, Pastor John P. Perkins, grandson of civil rights leader John M. Perkins.
What's been on your mind this week?
Man, this week has been, I mean, I guess for everybody, it feels like this whiplash. You know, it's like you go back and forth between all these different things that that we're thinking about, you know. So there's thinking about George Floyd himself, mm-hmm. right? And then, you know, pretty quickly it started to move into, you know, this bigger protest movement. And then the narrative switched to riots and whether riots were okay. And then it switched to policing and defunding the police. And then there's also, you know, this kind of the rise of the reactionary media, you know, people posting quite a bit of stuff that is designed in various ways to undercut the movement of it. Well, and it's not even really clear what specifically it's designed to undercut. It feels kind of like blunt, you know, tools, you know, just trying to discredit whether it's Black Lives Matter or, I think the thing that has been most confusing to me has been the attempt to discredit George Floyd himself. Like, that doesn't even make sense.
No kidding.
Like, yeah, it just feels very, I don't know.
But you know, that's been a trend though. And I think a lot of the events that have happened with Black folks in this country when it comes to the police is, I feel like when those sort of incidences happen, a narrative that I've heard frequently is immediately trying to go to how is that person at fault?
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
And I don't know if that's because the police are involved and they and white folks in general just kind of maybe assume, well, if the policeman's there, they must have done something wrong, or if there's just this other layer of assumptions, maybe even prejudices. What's so frustrating about the George Floyd discussion as it relates to that is, I mean, what are we going to sit here and dispute? As if any of that really has any question to play into the injustice that was done to kill him. Mm-hmm. That's the problem for me. Why would that even be a part of the conversation? As if somehow a person's life in those circumstances are now justifiably put in harm's way because of some petty things like that. I was talking with some friends about this, and I'm like, I know plenty of folks who've gotten DWIs. You know, I know plenty of folks who've had misdemeanors and whatnot, and yet none of my friends would dare even suggest that somehow that would warrant something like what happened to George Floyd. Mm-hmm. And yet when it happens to George Floyd, somehow it's brought into the conversation. I don't know. That's very frustrating. And I don't know how to pinpoint it, but to say that there's got to be things going on there beneath the scenes that need to be brought to the surface. Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing that's been concerning to me, I mean, there have been a few things this week, but one has just been what appears to be a disregard for the well-being of the press, you know. And then of course there's the whole clearing of the square for the photo op. I think that's this question that I think I'm wrestling with right now is like, what does it look like to, you know, to figure out what to be passionately committed to and stay grounded in, and at the same time, you know, what does health look like? You know, because ultimately, like, These are things. I mean, you and I have been involved in a committee that's been working on this kind of stuff for years and seeing almost no, and by this kind of stuff, I guess I should be more specific. We've been involved on a committee that's been working on, you know, intercultural competence and issues of, you know, racial tension and things like that for mm-hmm. years. And it is so painfully slow. Right. Yeah. Like, that's, you know, and then thinking about people whose daily lives are this, right? And we have friends that's the case for. And I think just, yeah, on the one hand, not wanting to lose focus, and on the other hand, wanting to be healthy. And I'm not sure what the, you know, where the connection is between those two things.
Well, and I think our work on that committee has opened my eyes up to a couple of things. I think that, you know, at the institution that we're at, there are people who are very sympathetic to the cause. And think about how hard change has been in the area of intercultural competence, even when you have people who are sympathetic to the cause, right, that are wanting to drive some of that change, it's still super slow. And in some ways, I don't want to suggest that our work on that committee is somehow equivalent to the Black Lives Matter movement or anything like that. But what I do wonder is if that's just a tiny little sliver of how difficult change in this area actually is. And then if you take that into the wider culture and you see a lot of these movements that are trying to make significant ground for racial equality and justice, I can't imagine with far wider systems that are even in place, I can't even imagine how difficult that change is when we're working on with one institution and we're working on micro levels in some ways, and those changes are that difficult.
Right, with a sympathetic audience, right?
Imagine those macro changes that are with a sympathetic audience, and that's just so, it's so reflective, so revealing in some ways. And yet the pessimist in me gets so frustrated thinking not just about the institutional slowness that we've seen, but thinking about the cultural changes, the wider cultural changes that need to happen. Like I can't even imagine. I don't even know. I can't describe how that could even occur well.
And then I feel like I have this mix of encouragement and discouragement as I think about the church and how the church has been interacting with all this. Mm-hmm. Like on the one hand, I see a lot of Christians jumping in ways that I never have before. And particularly white Christians that are finding a voice and that are either educating themselves or making it look like they're educating themselves. Right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, hopefully they're, you know, actually pressing into some of that. And that I find really encouraging. And on the other hand, I also see, you know, out of that same community, some of the, I don't know, whether it's, you know, the different logical fallacies, the red herring argument of like, well, what these people actually want is such and such, or, you know, or whether it's, yeah, the attempts to discredit. And then I think also there's always this, I'm always just a little bit nervous when something that I care about becomes popular. Mm-hmm. Have we talked about this before? I don't remember. So here's an example. I remember when the book When Helping Hurts by Corbett and Tickert came out. Mm-hmm. So they had an article out first, and I think it had either the same or a similar title. And that's the kind of stuff I had already been teaching about that stuff for a couple of years when it came out, and had certainly been thinking about that stuff for a while. And I remember being really encouraged when the article came out, because it was just like, yeah, this is solid stuff. And it kind of articulated what I'd been wanting to say, you know, in a really clear and coherent way. And then the book came out and it got really popular. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And I was like, why is this book so popular? And it took me a long time to read the book because it got so popular that I was just like, something's wrong. Something's wrong. I finally, actually, one of the times that I was in Mali, I read the book and I realized, I think, what it is that was a disconnect. So like the first half of the book is pretty harsh for people who are involved in various types of development ministry and care ministries of various kinds, especially in an international context. But a lot of it applies here too, right? The second half of the book, I don't know if it's halves or what, but anyway, the second part of the book presents a particular solution, which is microfinance. And that's a fine solution, right? But it is an insufficient solution. And applied wrongly, it can actually be a bad solution. And I think what I saw happening was that a bunch of the people that rallied around that book picked up on that. And they're like, oh, okay, we feel bad. There's this bad problem that we're a part of, but there's this simple solution and that makes everything better.
Yeah.
You know, and without actually doing the hard work of figuring out, what does it mean to listen to the local community? What does it mean? I mean, and you can do microfinance in those good ways, but also you can kind of take the easy way out on it. Does that make any sense?
It does, yeah. I wonder if it goes the other way too, where that books that are demonized within the church sometimes have a lot more truth to it than we're willing to admit as well.
Oh, interesting.
I started reading this book, The Power Worshippers, Which I'm telling you, you gotta read it, and we gotta consider it, I think, for faith, religion, political powers.
Okay,
wherever that class goes, that's by Catherine Stewart, who's a reporter, and the subtitle is "Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism."
Oh, interesting.
And it talks a lot about religious nationalism, which, by the way, it distinguishes between that and evangelicalism, which I really appreciate, because the author says this is not about evangelicalism, because there are evangelicals who dislike religious nationalism, but it is Christian religious nationalism, though, that it's focusing on, and it's a particular association with the Trump presidency, which gets us, maybe we're a little off topic here, but the reason why I thought was interesting was because if we're talking about thoughts this past week, and we think of the photo op with Trump holding on the Bible, I don't mean to speak ill of the president here entirely, but I'm a skeptic to the extent that so much of the public discourse and the public components to the religious discussions and politics, to me, feel like photo ops. You know, they feel like they're there just to rope people, religious people, in to associating with a particular political regime. And it's deeply frustrating for me, because I think sometimes religious folks buy it hook, line, and sinker. And so in some ways, I think that this book, you know, you're frustrated with the popularity, right, of that book. And I'm frustrated in some ways with, I'm sure, how this book might be demonized in a lot of Christian circles, because it has a lot of truth. I think that it's speaking to, and I haven't finished it yet, but talking about political discourse and what's happened in the last week. And then some of the contrast between the ways that people have responded to George Floyd incidents and the way that the president has responded, or lack thereof, has been, I think, a bit frustrating. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that because I feel like now is the time to cut the political lines even worse, so that, you know, down with Republicans and up with Democrats or anything like that. I think it's more of just, can there be legitimate conversation publicly about these kinds of photo ops and things that are going on that I find to be unhelpful?
So that is, I think, this other piece that it has been discouraging, is this recognition that there is, so I could see somebody hearing what you've just said and characterizing you as a Democrat.
Yeah. Right?
Which I happen to know isn't accurate.
Is not accurate.
and I think that is one of the things that's really frustrating to me, is I feel like, okay, we've got this election season coming up, and I'm like, I want to talk about some of that stuff, right?
Yeah.
You know, we have talked about those things. You know, so the whole idea of this podcast is profs in rooms getting coffee. What would we be talking about if we were sitting around having coffee? Well, we would be talking about that, but it feels like there's almost not space to have that conversation, because it feels like any nuance is just ignored, you know, or not welcome.
No, do you remember, you know, in class, in our faith, religion, political powers class, we talked about this a bit. And I think I made an analogy in there that I think holds up pretty well. And that is, I've got friends who are so all in with their sports teams that you will find them justifying anything that team does, as if they can't speak a negative word against them, you know, and even a bad game is somehow written off as the ref's problem, or, you know, bad refereeing, or
even cheating,
Yes. And I find it to be a similar kind of narrative that happens in the political realm. It's like people who are committed to specific parties, not all people, some people are committed to specific parties, they cannot do any sense of self-critique, or it's somehow rejection of the whole system. And I don't understand that. Part of it's because I don't understand it in the sports world. I mean, I've been a Vikings fan my whole life, and yet I have no problem seeing the shortcomings and the downfalls of my own team. And yet, can you still be committed to your team? You know, now my friends, I think, will call me out on that, because they know that I've kind of started to trend towards being a Chiefs fan. But so maybe I'm part of the problem here, right?
See, that's how we know. Once you open up that door to criticism, you're on your way out.
Maybe that's the concern. But politically speaking, yeah, I think there's no problem. I think you should be able to say, no, I'm fully on board with this political party, or I really support what the president's doing here or there, while also being able to say, you know, that I didn't like that move, or I didn't. And I feel like there's certainly trends in the political conversations where that's not allowed. It's like, no, you've got to defend your guy or your party to the end. And sadly, it usually is your guy, right? Every once in a while, you're a woman. But in the sense that there's just no room for critique, I think that's terribly unhelpful.
Yeah. You know, it makes me wonder, I'm thinking about something. So Ken Young over at Northwestern has a book called The Trouble with Racial Reconciliation, which is very useful. He looks at a number of different Black theologians and their take on racial reconciliation, what would be required to have that happen. But one of the things that he talks about in that book is this idea of compensatory identity and the way in which our primary identity, with Christ has been broken or lost, and we compensate with other identities. And so, maybe a less important one, relatively speaking, would be sports, where you compensate for your broken identity by identifying with this team. And we see around the world examples of where that gets taken really far, actually.
Yeah, people, even sports, other people get murdered at times, right? In significant situations where there's such rivalries that it leads to rioting in sports.
And when we think about where is that coming from, it's like, well, it's partly coming from this need to compensate for a broken identity.
Well, and the idea also, I think, of that to challenge that aspect of a person's identity is like to challenge the core of who they are. So right. the fact that it's become a, how'd you say it? Compensatory
identity.
Yeah. It brings it closer to the central identity, at least in people's minds, so much so that to attack your team or to attack your political party is to attack you, mm-hmm. right? Because of the fact that the compensatory identity has maybe become a centralized one mm-hmm. in an unhealthy yeah. way.
And so he applies that to race, that we have these identities that we're using to compensate and how, whiteness and blackness, as we understand them, don't even really exist except as social constructs. And so for him, the way that we get to racial reconciliation includes a process of deracialization, which is not the same at all as colorblindness, right?
Yeah, explain the difference, because I know I've heard some colorblindness things being said in some of the recent narratives, which basically the brands that I've heard in light of the George Floyd stuff have been like, we just need to see everybody as the same. We just need to, and it's certainly coming a lot from white folks. And so flesh out some of that distinction. I think that's important what you're bringing up.
Yeah. I think actually this is one of the things I like about that old DC Talk song.
Colored People, that one?
Yeah. Yeah. Because it has that celebration of difference. So colorblindness, basically, one of the main reasons that colorblindness is not a great goal is that it involves diminishing a person's self. Well, you know what? Let's ask John when he gets here.
Yeah.
We'll be back in a moment with Pastor John P. Perkins. Okay, so I'm really excited about this today. A friend of mine, Pastor John Perkins from Jackson, Mississippi, Common Ground Covenant Church. And we have been working together. Let's see, I think we met in maybe 2009. So it's been a little bit. We've been working together. I actually used to send students to spend a semester with John at the Spencer Perkins Center in Jackson, Mississippi. And then recently, he's also one of the authors of Commission to Love with Anthony Bobo, who was actually on the podcast, I think episode 5 or something like that. Yeah, John, really excited to have you with us today.
Thank you all for having me.
John, you're a pastor in Jackson, Mississippi. And you're also a participant in another podcast, aren't you?
Yes, Postulating Solutions with Preachers. Hopefully this podcast will catch on and as well as sitting down and having a cup of coffee with the professor will as well.
So something that might be helpful, John, is so a lot of people might be familiar with your name. John Perkins because of your grandpa, who is also John Perkins. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about Dr. Perkins and, you know, how his ministry has impacted you?
Oh, absolutely. Dr. Perkins is my grandfather, and he discipled me and discipled me in the scriptures in the Bible, and was the one who I went to when it was time for me to learn. And he had always been inviting me since I was knee-high to a pup to engage in the scriptures. As a matter of fact, I learned economics from my grandfather. He gave us he was selling books, and he gave us he cut me and my brother a deal. He said, "I will give y'all 5% of whatever y'all sell." And so we worked real hard, real hard. I'm 10 and my brother's 8. And so, of course, I did a little bit more work than he did. But we ended up making $200, you know, back then. He was selling Quiet Revolution for $5, things like that. So made $200, 5%. We had to split $10. I wanted a 20. I wanted to walk home with a 20. He talks about learning to be educated. This is a man with a third grade education with about 15 honorary doctor degrees, but he began to be educated one day when he worked all day expecting a dollar or a day's wage. But at the end of the day, the guy gave him a dime and a buffalo nickel and gave him 15 cents. He wanted to throw the 15 cents on the ground, but he began to be educated that day because he began to ask the question, what is it that he has that I don't have? He says he has the means of production. He has the wagon, the hay, the mule, and the field. And he said, I have to obtain the wagon, the hay, the mule, and the fields. And learning that helped me to establish what I was going to do and was going to be. I knew from a very young age that I was going to be one who needed to provide the means of production and sell the goods, as well as create jobs, as well as speak on behalf of the people. And so Dr. Perkins, my grandfather, my dad, and my mother knew each other in grade school. And there was one occasion in which they came for Dr. Perkins, and he said, if one of us going to jail, all of us are going to jail. He had his youth group. And so he said, y'all got to take all of us to jail. And so,
was this in Mendenhall?
This is in Mendenhall. Absolutely. So,
what was the context there in terms of the pressures and the possibility of going to jail?
Well, this was at the height of the civil rights movement. This was, and Dr. Perkins was the target. He was the main leader in the Simpson County area, as well as, you know, like a little north there, you know, Megar Evans had been killed. And he's one of the predominant leaders now, but he's down here, down south here, okay? But it's more dangerous down south because you can more easily be killed than even in Jackson. That makes sense. And so they came to arrest him. And my mother, God rest her soul, she just passed this February. But she said, I was not going to jail. So she ran the other way. She ran the other way. And that began the case that put Dr. Perkins on trial for endangering a minor. And it was my aunt, my mother's sister, who did not run away, who was younger than she was, that ended up being the one on trial. And so his life and my parents' lives were very much so intertwined. And my mother came from poverty in a lot of ways. But, you know, back in those days, everybody did. And so, you know, you didn't know you were poor. You know what I mean? You didn't have such a, you know, a poor mindset, but you knew cognitively once you got of a certain age that you wanted to be educated, so on and so forth, and to have some type of upward mobility. And so Dr. Perkins was one who put together what is now known the philosophy of Christian community development, because he saw the people within the community. He saw what was called the quarters, and it's still called the quarters today on the other side of the track. That's called the slave quarters, right? On the other side of the tracks, where he said that he saw that the people didn't have the hope. But he said to his wife, he said, and this is my grandmother, he said, honey, if we're going to make a difference in this town, we're going to have to help our people get a love for themselves and a love for God that's greater than consumerism, materialism, selfishness, and greed. And that began the work of Christian community development.
So then you, when we met, you were running the Spencer Perkins Center, or I think you started running it shortly after we met. So that was something that grew out of the work of Dr. Perkins, an attempt to actually work out Christian community development in Jackson. How did you get involved with doing that work?
Well, in 1998, my Uncle Spencer passed away, and my father felt a call and a pull to ministry. And so he moved us from Dallas, Texas to Jackson, Mississippi. And my mother and my father began the work of starting the Spencer Perkins Center underneath the John and Vera Mae Perkins Foundation. And so it was at that time, he was the executive director and my mother was the financial officer. And then, you know, a little later, February 2010, I was the executive director and my brother was the financial officer. So go figure.
And then your church has continued on that same kind of the church plant that came out of your work there, Common Ground, Covenant Church has carried on some of those same kinds of things, right?
Yeah, I'm accused of being a church that operates like a nonprofit. And I just tell them, you just don't understand that we're doing something in the neighborhood. We're doing something in the community. But so we are committed to the work of holistic Christian community development. We are joining our Lord Jesus in the work that he's doing in West Jackson. And we are loving our neighbors, and our neighbors are loving us. We have established a barbershop and beauty salon, which is weathering the storm of COVID-19, which is a social enterprise. We have also started a lawn care service, which lawn care has been essential. These are essential workers. Therefore, we are weathering the storm of COVID-19. And now we're on our way to, we have developed a family life center. That family life center at the beginning of COVID-19 was able to feed children breakfast and lunch for about 2 weeks before the schools opened up and was able to feed. And this was the barbers, you know, my lead barber, you know, sort of leading the charge in doing so, as well as, you know, those who operate the Family Life Center. So, yeah, we are doing something that I think is very very special in the community. And I'm very proud of it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
John, what's your reaction been to all the events that have gone down here lately in Minneapolis with the death of George Floyd? I'd be interested to hear what's your initial reaction to seeing these events happen and then seeing the reactions that have been happening around the country?
Yeah, these events have brought me to my knees to pray. I have autoimmune hepatitis, therefore I couldn't go out there and march right now if I wanted to, okay? But there's no way I can condone looting or burning down anything. But I do understand the sentiment of where that anger comes from. But again, I do not condone it, for which it causes me to pray. As well as on the other side, you know, we are a nation who has oppressed a people and people of color. And I am one of those people and have felt it in and throughout my life, living in Mississippi, living in the South. And I would be lying to you if there aren't many times that I put race first. There goes the rub, right? And the idea of me putting race first is the fact that me understanding that I'm Black and understanding that my people are Black and wanting justice for my people. And so at times, that rub and animosity and anger and vitriol comes out instead of love, because hey, that flag is still flying in the state of Mississippi. Okay. Mm-hmm. We have the harshest laws probably in the country, okay, which produces a prison population like none other. Okay. And that is pretty true for the South, right? And this is a perpetuation of a type of slavery, because these are people who are working and they're getting paid a dime an hour, 5 cents, 7 cents an hour. Make no mistake about it. Slavery is alive and well in this country today. Mm. So it causes me to pray. I understand my position as a pastor, and I think about the position of the church and where we are and the fact that God has chosen us to be the ones who love. In every one of the books that I sign, I put John 13:35, by this may all people know you are my disciples, by the love you have one for another. Love, we gotta love. It's hard to love when it's hard for me to want to go and preach. I'm like Jonah, right? It's hard for me to want to go and preach to the person who is the senator, my senator, when my senator just said, when she was running for office, she said something of this sort, and I paraphrase, if he invited me to a public lynching, I would be on the front row.
Wait, I remember that event.
So one of your senators in Mississippi,
yeah, that's
all, had said that they want to be at the front row of a lynching.
If this person, she was credentialing a person, yes. Mm. And that was her expression to do so. And this lets you know what the backroom conversation is, if she's willing to say something like that. If she's willing to say something like that, that lets me know what the background conversation is. You know what I mean? So, so when I see what happened in the North in Minneapolis, just miles away from my buddy's church, in which I've preached at multiple times, and seen Brother George Floyd being choked by having his life choked out by a police officer whose job is to protect and serve the society in which he is a part of. It makes for a very, very tough day for us all. So it brings me to my knees. It's brought me to my knees.
One of the things that I noticed, and I don't know how accurately I was perceiving this, but I felt like some of my Black pastor friends, after the death of Ahmaud Arbery, and even at first after the death of George Floyd, it almost felt like there was a hesitancy to engage it. And I don't know, I'm curious if that was right. I was talking with another Black friend of mine who I was, you know, mentioning this observation, and we were just talking about how, like, there's this sense in which this kind of thing, you know, police brutality, things that oughtn't be legal, that these things happen so often that if you stop to engage them every time they happen, you would not be able to move forward with the agenda of creating a society in which they don't happen. Is that right?
We might be able to say that and give a person that kind of benefit of a doubt, you know. But the truth is, in my personal opinion, we have assimilated and gotten too comfortable with where we are in life, and with some of us being where we are in life, and have not and do not want to lose said position. And in losing said position, you know, with the things that we will say and the things, if standing up to it and doing those things, you may have feelings on the inside, but if I don't want to lose my position and I don't want to lose my status, and I don't want to offend the people who are, you know, who I'm tied to, it's to my benefit not to say anything, you won't say anything. Mm.
So do you feel like more pastors should be speaking out?
Oh, absolutely. It's every man for himself. It's every man for himself rather than everyone for the kingdom and everyone for justice and equality. That is the mission of the United States, equality for all. But I want the mission for Jesus to reign, that all are loved, that everyone is loved.
So what's your initial reaction then when you see folks who are maybe in positions of authority or pastors who aren't speaking out against the things that are happening and in the ways that have been, there maybe been some unhelpful responses even in society? Do you feel like it's a necessity then that people in position of power and especially pastors will speak out against these sorts of things?
Yes, in particular the church speaking to the power of the nation and saying, this is not right. The church should be taking the position of the prophet Nathan, figuring out the way in which it says what it needs to say to the king.
Even when it's painful.
And standing up and saying what needs to be said. The church should be Samuel. Samuel is a boy still when he has to tell Eli what thus said the Lord. Mm.
This has been part one of a two-part discussion that includes John. Watch for the second part in episode 13 tomorrow. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. We hope you can join us for coffee again tomorrow. Be sure to check the show notes for details related to our conversation.